The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 21st of March 2023 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Allianz Partners. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's program, as Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit to Moscow enters its second day, we look at what to expect. Plus, former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan continues to sow political chaos. Then, Monocle's Washington correspondent Chris Chermak will be joining us.
I'm Chris Chermak in Washington, and I'll be discussing whether charges potentially brought in New York could be the first of many against former President Donald Trump.
And finally, why one luxury brand is turning to dynamic pricing. All that plus the latest business headlines right here on The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. Chinese President Xi Jinping's three-day visit to Moscow continues today. Yesterday, he already had informal talks with Russia's President Vladimir Putin. Today, more formal talks are set to take place. Everything from the war in Ukraine to trade being on the agenda. Joining me on the line for more is Isabel Hilton, China expert and visiting professor at King's College London. Welcome to the program, Isabel. Basing on what you've heard so far and what's been reported, what is your impression of what the mood is like during this visit?
Well, it seems to be a very lavish display of solidarity and friendship between the two. I've detected no note of caution on the part of Xi Jinping. So he continues pretty much as was, and at a very resonant moment just after the indictment for war crimes, but also on the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. So I think Xi Jinping is just leveraging this moment to perhaps point up the message to emerging economies that, you know, the West is hypocritical, China is rising above it, and reinforcing the worldview that he and Putin now share.
It's already been reported earlier today that Xi Jinping has also invited Putin to visit China later this year. Does this all signal that Moscow and Beijing are indeed getting closer to each other?
Well, they're certainly getting closer in some respects. If you look at the trade figures, you know, there's been a real boom in Sino-Russian trade over the past year, which is largely China taking up the energy surplus that Russia was left with after Germany disconnected. And what's significant, I think, for both of them is that an increasing percentage of that trade will be conducted in rubles or renminbi rather than dollars. And this is part of China's longer-term strategy to insulate itself from any potential consequences of a crisis in Taiwan, for example. So this is a laboratory experiment for China in looking at the kind of sanctions, the degree of pressure that can be put on an economy, and taking steps to ensure that China is insured against a future potential.
Obviously, Ukraine will be one of the topics during those discussions. What do you think these leaders will have to say to each other about that topic?
Well, I think that they might both want to be looking towards a resolution. The resolution that China has put forward protects Russia's interests in the sense that it proposes a ceasefire, which certainly Ukraine judges to be to Russia's advantage. However, it also proposes respect for territorial integrity and national sovereignty, which is very much on the Ukrainian agenda. So I think that Xi Jinping will be trying to reassure Putin that China would not propose a settlement that went against Russia's interests. Though quite how that circle is to be squared remains to be seen.
If you look at what China wants from this visit and what Russia wants from this visit, what does the power balance look like to you? Is Putin willing to do what she is asking?
Well, I think he will be willing up to a point. You know, after all, if you look at the power balance between North Korea and China, it's clearly in China's favor, but they've never really managed to get North Korea to do exactly what they want ever. And I think there may be a little bit of that with Putin. So, you know, China is very much the big brother now. It has the bigger, more secure economy. You know, it has greater standing in the world, and there is a degree of dependence. But, you know, Putin is a prickly and difficult character. And if China were to make him feel that dependence, he might, you know, kick at the traces slightly. And China certainly doesn't want Putin to fall, and it doesn't want to have a problem with Russia. So there will be a certain amount of smoothing, and giving face to Putin is very much on the cards at the moment.
Now, China officially hasn't picked its side when it comes to the Russia-Ukraine conflict, but it certainly sends a message by visiting Moscow. Do you think it's realistic to expect that she would visit Kyiv anytime soon?
Well, that would be dramatic, but the only leader who's currently planning to visit Kyiv is the Japanese prime minister, which is again another indication of the geopolitical balance that various leaders are striking. Were Xi Jinping to visit Kyiv, it would be dramatic, but at the moment I think that's not quite on the cards. Perhaps he's saving it up for later.
What do you expect from the rest of this visit then? Will we get announcements later? To say tomorrow,
I think we'll get announcements on trade in particular. I think we'll get announcements on with the sort of rhetoric that we've seen before, and we saw in the China-Russia statement of more than a year ago now, of, you know, solidarity, of protecting each other's core interests, and of essentially China still calling for peace without doing a great deal to bring it about.
Now, the rest of the world is anxiously keeping an eye on whether China will offer more support to Russia. What do you expect in that sense? Do you think Putin may get a bit of help from China eventually?
Well, he is getting help in the sense that, you know, China has a dual use strategy. So things like digital communication, satellite data, all that sort of geophysical data, which is now very much part of modern warfare, is pretty much being made available. And, you know, civilian drones can be deployed in war. So that kind of material is there. Were it to come to Russia's request for, you know, China has a large stock of Russian military equipment, for example. I think China is still hesitating because, you know, were that to be discovered, that really blows China's pretensions to being a kind of above the fray, you know, peace-loving negotiator. If you're supplying materiel to Russia, I think that would be quite difficult. It would also trigger secondary sanctions and really damage relations with the European Union. So China is balancing its interests there, I think.
Isabel, thank you very much for joining us today. That was Isabel Hilton. And now here is Monica Scarlett Rebello with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Sri Lanka will get the first $330 million tranche of an International Monetary Fund bailout in the next 2 days, putting the onus on the country to rein in its debt. Economic mismanagement coupled with the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic has tipped the island nation into its worst financial crisis in 7 decades. French President Emmanuel Macron will break his silence tomorrow to outline plans after his administration narrowly survived a no-confidence motion over a deeply unpopular pension reform. More than 200 people were arrested across the country yesterday evening as spontaneous protests broke out over the parliamentary vote. And the Brazilian Appeals Court has agreed to rule on whether companies and farmers can plant cannabis in the country, opening the door for legal cultivation for medicinal and industrial purposes. The court's final ruling on cannabis, expected within the next year, could make it a trailblazer on a topic spurned by many in Brazil's conservative-leaning Congress. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Marcus.
Thank you very much, Carlotta. And now it's time to get to the latest business headlines with Bloomberg's Euan Potts. Euan, welcome to the programme. It's obviously been a dramatic week for the banking sector, but we are seeing some signs of the dust settling today, aren't we?
Hello, Marcus. Yeah, I'm just looking at the screen of the biggest gainers on Europe's Stock 600. Commerzbank, UniCredit, Banco de Sabadell, NatWest Group, Bank of Ireland among the top performers. That's just a snapshot of what the sector, of what the investors think of the sector at the moment. There are hopes that the worst has now passed. Of course, we had that dramatic news over the weekend of one of the world's systemically important banks being bailed out by its neighbour and its rival of many decades. Credit Suisse, of course, a cornerstone of the Swiss finance industry. One of only 30 systemically important banks around the world, but it has been stumbling for years and years from one scandal to another. And the crisis triggered in the US last week of regional bank failures meant it was just something that it couldn't survive. So that bailout took place rather rapidly over the weekend. Monday, investors really took stock of that. A lot of concern about the banking sector and could this be a wider risk? But I think there is a feeling today that regulators will step in to make sure that this doesn't go out into the wider economy and affect the sector more widely. So bank shares rising today. I think a more interesting question more widely is the economic effects and what will this mean for central banks hiking paths. We get rate decisions from the Federal Reserve tomorrow and from the Bank of England on Thursday. The ECB's Christine Lagarde being pretty clear that the stability of the banking system is different to price stability and that the bank will not let the two things become confused. But a lot of investors are betting that rate rises are going to be more muted from the world's central banks, that they're not going to risk increasing rates by quite as much as they would have done. Of course, we were already expecting rate rises to come to an end in the next few months anyway, but investors have been dialing back on bets as to when that will happen. So that could slow the path of rate rises. That is the central scenario of a lot of investors at the moment.
And looking at some other news, yet another big company is pulling back from the Chinese market. Tell us more.
Yeah, just a little snippet of news from a very big asset manager, Vanguard Group, one of the world's three biggest asset managers, the big American group. They manage $7 trillion of assets, pension funds and investments. They have decided to completely leave the Chinese market. Now, they've notified the Chinese government of their intention to shut their unit in Shanghai. They had been attempting to compete in China. A lot of other of its competitors are still going ahead. We know that they are still investing in China, BlackRock and Fidelity, both trying to grow their businesses there. But Vanguard feel that they cannot make a profit there and they cannot compete in the country. So they've so far been booking a loss in China and they have decided to pull out of the Chinese market. It's a pretty significant move for a very big company. But yeah, it's another sign of the deglobalization taking place. A big US asset management firm leaving China.
Euan Potts there, thank you very much. It's 12:12 here in London. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
You asked, we delivered. Welcome to The Concierge, a travel show from Monocle, brought to you in association with Allianz Partners. This week, we take an off-season trip to Ibiza to see what the island has to offer.
One of the keys to the island is actually how vulnerable and authentic can you be. And when people feel that you're real, whatever it is, that's what's celebrated here.
And take a gastronomic tour to Östersund in Sweden.
Here you serve a lot of Swedish fika. It's kind of like the Nordic afternoon tea, but we do it all day.
The Concierge, in association with Allianz Partners. Listen via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your audio.
You are back with the briefing on Monocle 24. Now to Pakistan, where former Prime Minister Imran Khan is continuing to sow chaos in the country and deepen political divisions. Since his removal from power last year, the former Prime Minister has been demanding a new election and holding protests across the country to press his case. Pakistan's parliament is set to meet in a special joint session tomorrow to take important decisions to enforce the state's authority. For more, I'm joined by Samira Shackle, journalist and author of Karachi Vice, Life and Death in a Contested City. Welcome to the programme and good afternoon, Samira. Could you first tell us to which extent the current chaos we are seeing is down to Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan and his demands for a new election?
I think it's down to that to a great extent. So Pakistan is... its transition to democracy has not been smooth, let's say. So this is a country that's spent more than half, around half of its history since independence under direct military rule. When it's not under military rule, the military continue to hold the reins of power. Imran Khan was ousted in April by a no-confidence vote in the parliament. And while that went through a sort of regular parliamentary procedure, which was carried out by civilian politicians, it's widely accepted that it was actually a large part of his downfall as prime minister was due to him falling out with the military establishment, who, as I say, hold the reins of power. And during his tenure as prime minister, were very overt, actually, about being the sort of power brokers in the country, even more so than under previous prime ministers. And so this is not unique to Imran Khan. I mean, many civilian leaders, I'd say the vast majority of civilian leaders, in fact, have been ousted by the military, either directly or indirectly, in Pakistan. What is unusual is that Khan is so unwilling to go quietly. So despite the fact that there was a sort of regular parliamentary procedure, a vote of no confidence that ousted him, he made all sorts of wild allegations, saying it was a conspiracy by the US, which was a clear attempt to play to the anti-Americanism of his base. And he's called big scale protests. He's really tried to sort of sow unrest, and he has refused to go quietly. And he's quite happy to call into question and cast doubt on the very fragile democratic institutions and state institutions of Pakistan in the process.
And Khan still has loyal followers. Supporters have taken to the streets on numerous occasions. What can you tell us about that and about how dangerous this situation is potentially?
I think the situation is very dangerous, and he does have loyal supporters. I think one of the, you know, I said earlier that the he'd fallen out of favour with the military, but it's also worth noting that he was a very popular politician, a populist politician, in fact, who fell out of favour with the public as well. And I think that was why he was able to be ousted in April. This is a country mired in a devastating economic crisis. He didn't create the crisis. It was already there when he came into office, but he didn't really do anything to ease it either. And so I think across the country at large, he's lost a lot of his general support, but he's always had an extremely committed band of followers who will, you know, follow him into whatever sort of protests and rallies and so on that he calls for. I mean, this isn't actually new. That's the other thing. Back in 2013, when Imran Khan's party, the PTI, became a sort of significant electoral force for the first time, but still lost the election by a long way, Khan refused to accept the result, which was a landslide for his opponents, and called months and months of protest in the capital city, Islamabad, bringing big unrest and so on, claiming without really much ground that it was a rigged election. So he's got form on this, as do his supporters, who are very loyal and very committed. And yeah, I think it's a very dangerous situation, because there seems to be no serious attempts or willingness on either side to de-escalate. So what were, you know, long-standing political enmities, it would just seem to be escalating and escalating, and it's hard to see how it ends well.
Now it's been announced that Pakistan's parliament is meeting tomorrow for a special joint session to take what's being called important decisions to try to get control of the situation. What do you expect?
It's hard to say, really. There have been overtures from Shahbaz Sharif, who's the current prime minister. He's noted that he's said publicly he's willing to engage in dialogue. I think Khan has made noises about this too. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens because, you know, there have been a really large number of criminal complaints, police cases lodged against Khan. I mean, again, this is not unusual. This is a fragile democracy. The majority of civilian leaders are jailed after their time in office, which is not the sign of a healthy democracy. I mean, his predecessor, Nawaz Sharif, and his daughter were both jailed on corruption charges. The prime minister before that, president before that, Asif Ali Zardari, who's Benazir Bhutto's widower, was also jailed on corruption charges. And so it's again, not without precedent that all these cases are being filed against Khan. What is without precedent is the level to which he's fighting it. And he's got supporters outside his house refusing to let the police through. He's escalating and escalating the situation, whereas previous civilian leaders have often, you know, basically decided to take the hit and do their time in jail and return to politics at a later date. Again, that's not a healthy system at all, but it is sort of how things have functioned before. And so we're on uncharted territory is Khan's unwillingness to go quietly and to sort of follow the precedent set in civilian military relations and also in how ousted leaders respond to the state when it turns on them.
How can this situation continue? What do you expect from the future then? Is Khan going to give in?
I don't think Khan is going to give in at all. I mean, as I said, even, you know, this has been sort of building up over the last decade or more. He's more than willing to speak the language of democracy and talk about defending democracy and so on. He's doing that even now, while also really damaging those institutions and faith in those institutions, which is already very fragile in Pakistan. It's a tinderbox situation at the moment. I think I mentioned the economic crisis. There's massive youth unemployment, businesses folding, currency crisis, shortages of water, electricity, long running problems, which are all reaching a kind of apex point. And so it's difficult to see, given there doesn't seem to be much willingness on Khan's part to give in. The sort of enmity between him and the current governing parties is growing and growing, and unrest on the streets is growing and growing. We know that in Pakistan, this can easily erupt into violence. It has already with these rallies. And so without someone giving ground somewhere, it's difficult to see how the elections, which are scheduled for October, go ahead without problems. I think there have been some worries from some commentators in Pakistan about a return to direct martial rule. I'm not sure that it's at that point yet, but I think we're going to see this sort of unrest and physical clashes continuing.
Samira Shackel, thank you very much for joining us today. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And now to the United States, where police across the country are preparing for potential unrest in case ex-president Donald Trump is arrested. This weekend, the former US president claimed he would be arrested this morning over an alleged hush money payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Joining us for more is Monocle's Washington correspondent Chris Jemek. Chris, good morning to you and welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Marcus. Good morning to you.
Now, what is the latest? How much do we know about what exactly is happening?
Well, in short, Marcus, we don't know that much because what is, of course, interesting about this is Donald Trump himself warned his supporters on social media that he would potentially be arrested today. That itself came from media reports. It did not come from any kind of official announcement, any official disclosure to him that today would be the day that he will be indicted. What we do know, though, is that it is close. There is certainly reporting that the New York attorney, the New York prosecutors are looking at indicting Donald Trump over the Stormy Daniels affair that you alluded to there. And that it is coming soon, whether it is actually today. There was a meeting with officials yesterday, also security officials in New York, about how to handle this potential arrest. And even at that meeting, the New York police officials were not given an exact time or a day for when Donald Trump will be arrested. So in that sense, stay tuned.
So how likely is it that Trump would indeed be arrested?
Well, it's not likely. It's not sort of what you imagine in terms of nobody's going to be going to Mar-a-Lago directly and trying to sort of, you know, break down the doors and lead him away in handcuffs. What is likely to happen is there would be a voluntary arrest, a voluntary appearance by Donald Trump in New York. Frankly, you can imagine that he might even relish that in terms of the way that he would be able to sort of parade in front of the stage there saying he was falsely charged and all the rest of it. So the likelihood is he would appear in New York. He would be arraigned in New York. There would be a mugshot, and that's something I'm sure he wouldn't like that much. And he would appear in court in order to plead not guilty to whatever charges are being brought, at which time he would be free to go again. He wouldn't even necessarily have to pay bail given the nature of the charges. So that's kind of what we can expect. Of course, you know, the idea of him appearing in court, and as you alluded to as well, what that would lead to, the protests, the kind of support he might get, particularly in New York, whether that could lead to any unrest, that is the big question.
What is the feeling at the moment in the United States? How dangerous is this situation?
Well, it's very, very hard to say, frankly, Marcus. I mean, there's a lot of talk about it, of course, but at the same time, the chatter in terms of what type of protests we're going to see has been very disparate, right? We don't know exactly where it's going to happen. Will it be New York? Will it be in other places? There haven't been any major, major organized protests that we know of, more sporadic. So in that sense, there isn't a huge amount of worry that this is the moment that leads to, you know, major, major unrest in the United States. And part of that, I have to say, Marcus, is because of the nature of the case. I think one of the things that's interesting about this, the irony, if you will, is that this case in New York with Stormy Daniels is, you know, arguably the sort of flimsiest case from a legal standpoint in terms of, you know, the charges are charges of falsifying business records. It's not even about the fact that he paid hush money to a former porn star. It's about how he paid that, how he went about it, where the money, how he documented the money. That's going to be a hard case to prove. But at the same time, it is an incredibly damaging case, arguably from a political standpoint for Donald Trump, just because of the optics of it. It's a little harder to argue when it's a case of hush money. You know, this doesn't look very good, and it's not something that even his supporters are going to be hanging their hat on as much as possible future charges in other cases when it comes to, you know, the 2020 election and whether he was rightfully elected or lost that election or not, or whether he the records that were found at Mar-a-Lago, the federal records that he kept from the White House, and whether that is something, you know, he mishandled classified documents. Those are major, major cases that also would, in his mind, you know, point to some kind of criminal conspiracy against him, the deep state conspiracy of the United States. In the case of New York, it's just a different nature. And you've even seen Republican candidates in that sense allude to that. Ron DeSantis, one of his biggest rivals, the Florida governor, you know, made this jab directly at him yesterday saying, well, I don't really know what goes into paying off a porn star for hush money, you know, hush money to a porn star. But what I do know is that New York should focus on other cases and crime in their city. So even, you know, the politics from Republican candidates shows that this is not really a good look for Donald Trump. It's not the biggest case, despite the fact that it would be the first time that a U.S. president is ever indicted, is charged in U.S. history with a crime.
Sadly, it doesn't sound like Donald Trump is going to disappear from the headlines anytime soon. Monocle's Chris Jermak in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much for joining us today. And finally on today's program, a luxury brand opts for a stock market style pricing model, but will it have the desired effect? New York-based brand Telfar, most famous for its tote bags, claims the new model will keep the brand affordable. To tell us more, we are joined in the studio by Monocle's fashion editor, Natalie Theodosi. Welcome to the program, Natalie. Could you first tell us a bit more about the brand and what it's up to now?
Of course. So Telfer is one of New York's youngest luxury brands, and it has really built a name because of its signature bags. It's very simple, durable leather totes with the T logo of the brand right at the front. And the reason why the bags have been so popular, it has been because the price is a lot more democratic than your usually luxury brands that price bags over $3,000. Telfer bags are around $300 usually, and still they have managed to position themselves as a luxury brand and grow a huge audience, from fashion editors to Beyoncé carries the bag to regular fashion consumers who can buy into that price point much more easily.
How is this new pricing model, how is it going to work?
So with the live pricing format, the Telfer will drop a new collection every week, I believe, and they will start offering the bags at wholesale price. So that's around 70-80% lower than the official retail price. And it's usually those kind of prices are usually reserved for buyers of stores who buy big quantities and then mark them up. So customers, now any customer will be able to buy the bag at that price point. And depending on demand, just like in the stock market, it will go up or down.
What are potential pitfalls in that? I'm still wondering about, you know, how this brand is seen as a luxury brand. Is this new pricing model, is it going to change that when obviously it's going to be much more affordable to buy these bags?
I think for Telfer in particular, because they have a lot of respect in the industry and a loyal audience, it's quite a safe bet. I think the demand is going to be quite high, and the price will go back to original retail price. So they're doing it, having tested the model, knowing that their bags are high in demand, and they also produce limited collections, limited amounts. So I don't think they're risking much or jeopardizing the brand image. And it's interesting that you say luxury is like they're changing their definition of luxury, right? Because we're used to luxury bags costing thousands of pounds. And in fact, I think Chanel just had another price increase of their luxury bags, which used to cost, you know, over $1,000, I think, over 10 years ago. And now they go from $10,000 up. This is a new proposition and a different approach to what luxury can be, where it's a good material, it's a great design, but by cutting the middleman, speaking directly to consumers and creating these small drops, you're making it a lot more democratic and accessible.
What is the likelihood that other brands will follow suit? Do you think we can expect that this is going to be a success and some other companies will be keeping an eye on how it's going to work?
It's interesting because, I mean, Telfer has been experimenting with different business models and having quite a lot of success for quite a few years now, but not many have copied or followed suit. In fact, I think the trend in the luxury world has been to raise the prices year after year. I think one of the few luxury bags at the moment from bigger heritage houses that is under $1,000 is a tiny leather bag by Alaïa. Everything else is $3,000 and upwards. So not many people are following suit, which means that anyone that wants to buy a luxury bag but has a more limited budget should just go to Telfer.
Mm-hmm. Monocle's fashion editor, Nathalie Theodosi there. Thank you very much for joining us today. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was Monica Lillis, and our studio manager was Adam Heaton. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time at 20:00 in Shanghai, midday here in London, 8 a.m. in New York City. I am Markus Hippi. Goodbye and thanks for listening.